The Why Didn't You Test That podcast. Want to improve your software? The team at Curiosity and their guests share experiences and insight on the many sides of better software delivery.
Welcome back to the next in the episode pods of Why Didn't You Test That. I'm Rich Jordan, enterprise architect at Curiosity Software. Joining me today as guest host again, I've got James Walker.
Hi everyone, thanks Rich.
And our very special guest today is Chris Harbour. Chris is an industry executive, international conference speaker, host of Developers Who Test podcast. I believe James was on the podcast very recently. MBA and founder and CEO of Testry, a company that has helped teams from startups to Fortune 500 increase test coverage and improve their CI/CD processes, including putting in place solutions that reliably run more than a million tests per month across multiple teams and testing frameworks. His love of software test automation started nearly 20 years ago when he was a developer doing test-driven development at a company that was early to adopt agile practices. Today, he shares his knowledge and experience with others so we can ship better quality software faster and have fun doing it. I love that bit at the end, have fun doing it. Welcome to the pod, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, Rich. Testry really does two things. One is we're a cloud-based provider for running automated tests. We support, I believe, we're up to 9 open source testing frameworks. So we help your tests run quickly and reliably and provide all kinds of nice functionality for being able to automatically rerun things, detect flaky tests, things like that. And then the other thing we do is we provide professional services to help teams get started with test automation or migrate from legacy frameworks to more modern frameworks or figure out why their tests are flaky.
Well, the topic of this pod, I should say, we had a bit of a discussion beforehand and we want to kind of explore the big topic of quality. All right. So a nice kind of softball question to get us going, Chris. What is quality?
You can come up with an answer that's correct or you can come up with an answer that's useful. Yeah. Right. So the correct answer is that ultimately the customer defines quality. It is whatever they want it to be. It's some combination of, am I getting the right functionality that I expect? Is it working every time I try to use it? Is it valuable to me? Is it a good experience? It's some combination of that and also just the more traditional, if I run the tests, are everything working correctly, right? And so The real definition that's probably most useful is probably somewhere between those two extremes, right?
James, how much thought do you think testing's actually put into exactly what Chris has just articulated there?
It's just different at every organization. Now, I definitely agree with Chris there. And I think there's two questions, I guess, is what are you trying to achieve? What's the value? And I guess this, which is just different across every organization, right? If you're in the financial services industry, there's huge risk, there's huge compliance. If you're a startup, the value you're getting from your test is probably widely different than what you're doing in that kind of environment. I think the other thing that I'm seeing a lot different of, which Chris, I would love to get your thought, is who actually owns quality in organizations now? Like there's so many different roles, so many different methodologies, so much different technology.
Yeah, who owns quality? It's the bystander paradox where if something bad happens and you're in a more crowded place, people are less likely to actually respond to it. As organizations, we're tempted to say that everyone's responsible for quality because ultimately we all take actions that contribute to whether or not the system is high quality. From, you know, the CEO, whether or not they say, hey, just ship it anyway, we've got to get this thing out before the conference, to the product owners who need to define things really well, to testers and developers. So we all do play a very important role in quality. But if we just say quality is everyone's responsibility, then you end up with this phenomenon where, you know, something goes wrong and everybody's walking by, but everybody feels like somebody else is going to take care of it. So I do think it's important for every organization to identify, you know, ultimately someone who's driving the quality initiative, whatever that looks like at the organization, and to have some kind of a program in place that coordinates the efforts across the team, that's keeping an eye on things like metrics, what tools are we bringing in, that sort of thing. But what does that look like kind of depends. You know, if it's a startup, it is going to look very different than if it's a Fortune 500 company.
It's interesting because it kind of transcends kind of a bit into the whole coverage and how much, how do you know how much is enough coverage? And I guess to a certain extent, you know, yes, it's good to have collaborative conversations and get responsibility around making sure that as a collective you've got responsibility, but who's that accountable person that says enough is enough? Right. I guess what kind of experiences do you have? A question to yourself, James, first of all, around kind of how does a test team know when enough is enough when it comes to coverage, and kind of what mechanisms can they use to make it a little more objective?
I mean, from my point of view, it always comes back to value and, you know, what you're trying to achieve, why you're doing it in the first place. And I think we're so guilty, especially in the quality space, to just move a million miles per hour, which seems to be, you know, it's easy to do in development. It's really hard to do that actually when you're testing. But to me, it comes back to coverage is obviously super important. You know, do I have enough coverage of my application that I can actually release confidently and kind of de-risk the release to a certain extent? I posted a blog on this a couple of weeks ago on vanity metrics in QA. And, you know, if you look at a lot of teams, it's how much code did I commit? It's how many test cases do I have running? But, you know, how big is my automation regression pack, right? But to me, it's have I de-risked the release? Do I have enough confidence to ship with? And can I assure that the wheels are still on to a certain extent, I think? And those are kind of the main things that I look at. And I think, you know, it sounds obvious, but it's so overlooked in most organizations, right?
What about yourself, Chris? Obviously, you know, being successful in automation is a great thing in testing, but sometimes that becomes the only metric that people are interested in. Is that something that you experience quite a lot, or is actually... I find in my personal experience that actually if you are very successful in doing automation, then actually that becomes a secondary measure and you become more interested in the whole rounder, how does the functionality work? How do we understand certain things? Is that a similar shared experience?
Yeah, so, you know, I got started in quality as a developer doing test-driven development. So I started out on the software side of things. And I was fortunate enough to work for a place that was highly disciplined about writing a test before every single line of code was written. So we were doing real test-driven development, pair programming. One person would write the test, one person would write the code. You'd go back and forth all day long, red, green, refactor, right? When I did that, that gave me an appreciation for a lot of the benefits that aren't easy to measure about test automation. And some of those benefits are things like, when I go to lunch and I get back from my lunch break, where did I leave off, right? If you have a failing test, it tells you where you left off. What are the requirements? If you have good automated tests in place, those can help document your requirements in terms of an executable specification. So you know what the previous developer did. And it also improves the architecture and design of your code. So as you're adding tests and as you're refactoring, you're able to improve the design to be something that's more resilient to incoming changing business requirements than if you just built the thing without having any tests in place. So there are a lot of these side benefits of testing. So I tense up a little bit when the conversation shifts towards, we have too many tests, how do we get fewer tests, right? Most often the case is, the test you want is the test for the defect that you just didn't bother writing, right? Yeah. It's usually not the case that you have too many tests that aren't valuable at all. Like, I have to be careful saying that, because if you have a lot of tests and they're flaky and you're unnecessarily reviewing failed tests, that's one thing. And if you don't have any kind of approach to... I call it the test selection problem, which is figuring out which tests to run at which point in the pipeline. So, you know, we all would obviously want to run every single test before we merge anything, right? And right down to security, performance, usability, user sign-off from product. Like, you would really want to do every kind of test before you merge, but you can't practically do that. So every team has to make some kind of compromise of, you know, what tests do I run before the developer commits everything? What tests do I run before it gets merged? What tests do I run before it gets deployed? And that's a tough problem to figure out. But I like focusing on that problem a little more than focusing on the problem of should we even have the test or not? Because I think most of the time you should have the test. It's just figuring out, does it belong as a unit test? Does it belong as an integration test, an acceptance, performance, and when are you going to run it?
It's not really a side question, but I'm interested in terms of almost, you know, that initial organization where almost they incubated you to have that belief, right? And I think I've got a very similar kind of background in terms of, you know, almost upfront systems and analysis upfront, understand what you're doing, then go and execute those kind of things. Could you pinpoint why did that organization do what they did when so many don't?
Yeah. So they were actually early adopters of Agile. This was in the mid 2000s, so around 2005, 2006 ish. So really pretty early to get into this. And at the time, they were doing a conversion from one programming language to another. And they thought that pair programming would be a good way of doing the knowledge transfer between the people who knew the new language and the people who knew the domain. And so they did a test project where it was an extreme programming team. They had a coach in place who coached everybody on what are the practices of extreme programming, and started doing like daily stand-ups and that sort of thing as they were doing this pilot project in the new technology. And so that was just how they ended up adopting it. And it rolled out to the rest of the dev teams because it worked, right?
So for your personal experience, when kind of the light bulb moment come on, you know, almost Agile is almost a bit of a side note, I think, and actually that way of working, there's a light bulb going on and said, actually, yes, this is the right way to do things.
You know, if you go back to the Agile manifesto and just look at the values, there's almost nothing controversial in the values of the Agile manifesto. It's like, we value people over tools. Well, who on earth values tools over people? I mean, in practice, at the time that the manifesto was written, companies were behaving in a way that they did value tools over people. And that's why it needed to be said. But as a principle, it's not controversial at all. And the idea of meeting regularly with customers, having customers take a look at stuff, keeping a prioritized list of things to do and working on the most important things first. You know, all of that is stuff that should be obvious. And I think what happens is we build up this entire process and ecosystem around those basic principles. And that's where some of the dogma can come in and be controversial. And, you know, do you want to estimate things in jelly beans or story points or ideal hours, right? But ultimately, at the core of it, it's doing what we should all be doing, and that's shipping working software as quickly as we can, showing it to customers, getting feedback, and iterating on that.
We talk to customers, you know, people who get it straight away, and therefore they really understand how tools can support them. And you've got people who I'm going to suggest are stuck in a bit of a rut. That either know there's a problem, they don't know how to change it, or they just don't know there's a problem.
And also, it's very easy, especially when you're in an enterprise environment. You know, you sometimes you get stuck in this mentality of, I only know what's in front of me and I only know what I've been doing for the past 10 years, right? When you go through that whole change process, change management situation, like it's a lot of effort, it takes a lot of time, you've got to get a lot of people bought in. And to me, it's no surprise people get stuck in that rut.
You know, I've dealt with a lot of change projects over the years. There's a really helpful model for it, Kotter's change model. First step is create a sense of urgency. And, you know, early in my career, as I was reading the book, you know, I started putting things into practice, you know, highlight some challenges in the organization and say, we really need to do something about it. And you set a schedule behind it. Yeah. That'll create that sense of urgency that people need to be motivated to change. You just need to read the entire book so that you know what steps are next. But I think when it comes to leading change, you know, probably the most important thing that a lot of teams miss when they're trying to do it is you need to put yourself in the shoes of the person you're asking to change and think about, well, what's really in it for them? Because there should be something in it for them. And you should be able to communicate it in their terms so that they understand why you're asking them to make the change. And, you know, tying it back into quality, there are a lot of teams that are trying to navigate you know, whether or not developers should own quality or testers should know how to write code. Should it be two separate roles? Should it be one role? And it's way too easy for someone to just come in without knowing who the individual people are without knowing their skills, backgrounds, desires, and say, this is the way that things should work in an ideal world, right?
Yeah.
But if you don't take into account the individual people and what they know, what they've experienced, what they want to be able to do, but they're being told they can't do, if you don't take all of those things into account, you're really doing those people a disservice, but you're also not going to have a successful change project. Because those people are like, well, why should I help out? I don't know where I'm going to end up here. I don't know what's in it for me. I want to do the right thing, but nobody's giving me that kind of guidance. And I think that's hugely important and something we can take to any kind of project we do, whether it's a QA project, you know, even if you're rolling out a new HR system, right? Like, why should people log into the new HR system instead of the old HR system, right?
Yeah. So, to expand on kind of the conversation slightly, in terms of, you know, some organizations, there is a divide between the developers and the testers. I guess, you know, you guys have got experience of both sides. I'm intrigued in terms of what kind of things do you see, or what kind of techniques are there to bring the two kind of communities or disciplines together? You know, I appreciate sometimes they might be the same people.
Yeah, so I've helped teams make the merge. I've even had that happen on teams I was managing before. I think the first thing that needs to happen is developing mutual respect. So a lot of developers don't respect QA folks. They don't appreciate the challenge that goes into testing, even if it's just manual testing. And when there are QA folks who do know how to write code, there's this assumption that, oh, they're not really that good at it. And I hate to say that, but I've encountered it in so many places that I think it's just, it's pretty common, right?
Yeah.
And I think the first way to dispel that is, you know, people on the testing side need to embrace software development. And they should be asking themselves, well, you know, do I know source control? Do I know branching strategies? Do I know design patterns? And really pushing themselves to learn those sorts of things. And they should be not just finding bugs, but this is usually the best place to start, is don't just find the bug, but ask for permission to be able to fix bugs too. Because how often do we... you know, as testers, we find a typo, and the typo would literally take less than 1 minute to fix if we just checked out the code, submitted a bug fix, and moved on.
Yeah. Right?
But instead, we enter it into Jira as a story. It gets submitted into a queue. A product manager picks it up and writes acceptance criteria on it. It spends a month in planning. There's so much waste involved in that when it's just a simple fix that could happen right away. And if the developer who's working on the code found that, by the way, they would just fix it, right? And so I think that's one thing is testers can, you know, start participating in bug fixes. They can check out the code and look at how it's working and use that to get inspiration for how to break it or find areas where there aren't coverage. So there are a lot of ways that those folks can be more involved with the dev side of things. And then the other side of that is developers can also embrace more kinds of testing. So, you know, it's most people understand why developers need to be heavily involved in unit testing, because it's at the method level. It's almost always in the same language, the same repo, side by side running it, right? But a lot of developers are scared to get into any kind of UI or end-to-end testing. Usually because they don't see what's in it for them because they haven't done it before. But if they've done it before and had a good experience, then they see like, oh, okay, this is so much easier than me personally testing all my stuff manually while I'm building the thing, right? That's probably where I would say folks should get started on either side of that, is developers like start writing some end-to-end tests and testers start fixing some bugs and work together on those things, right?
What about yourself, James?
And I don't know if this is just because of the shift from waterfall to agile that we've kind of seen this almost shift in mindset, right? Because now most organizations care a lot more about quality And I think I see it a lot in our development team now, where there's actually, and I don't know if this is just because of the process and kind of what we've sculpted in our development team, but we care a lot about quality. And it kind of hurts as a developer if you see your code go out to a customer using your feature and all of a sudden there's all these defects associated with it, right? Like that's bad. Whereas before, I feel like it was always, let's blame the testing team. They didn't test it well enough. And now I feel like there's more of a kind of chain of culpability where it ends up coming back to the developer and they have to spend time fixing it. And it's like, actually, if we did more work up front with quality and making sure we're pumping out good code, which meets the initial requirements and it's acceptable, then, you know, we have less work coming back on us later on.
I think organizations care about quality, but I think I think they're struggling to execute on how to deliver with quality. You know, we've created systems that are overly complex. So, you know, there are a lot of startups that are trying to do Kubernetes and microservices deployed to multiple cloud providers just to create a website, right? And, you know, that's more complex than what their system needs to be. And as a result, they're facing more issues. Like some of these problems have always been really hard to solve. Like, how do you test asynchronous messaging queues where things are guaranteed to be delivered, but not necessarily guaranteed to be delivered in order? Like, there are a lot of really challenging problems when you get into distributed computing. And more we're seeing like everyone try to take on those challenges, whether their system really needs it or not, right? And so in my day-to-day life, I don't know about yours, I'm guessing this is true, but in my day-to-day life, I don't think I can get through a single day without encountering two or three bugs from the various companies I depend on for my services, whether it's the navigation in my car or, you know, a Windows application crashing in the morning, you know, the display not looking correct when something happens, or even a bug on a website, right? These things happen in our daily lives, and I think we've just gotten numb to it, to be honest. Like we're just kind of getting desensitized to poor quality applications. And so I personally, I mean, that's part of why I started the podcast, is I'm on a mission to bring back quality, because I think quality isn't what gets somebody to buy your software, but it is what gets somebody to continue to use your software and to have a good experience and like your company. So if you want to have, you know, good employee retention and employees who are proud to work on a product, and if you want to have loyal customers who really like to use your product and tell other people about it, quality is like baked into all of these things, right? And I think we as an industry need to bring the rigor back to it. There were a lot of good reasons to say, hey, developers, you should own quality. But if you just say that without giving them the proper support and without considering who's going to be owning the quality program for the company, who's going to be making sure you're bringing in the right tools, processes, training people, if you don't have all of that figured out, then you can say you care a lot about quality, but you're not doing what it really takes to deliver a quality result.
You know, there's a lot of experimentation around testing at the moment in terms of who undertakes it, who owns quality. You know, a lot of organizations are cutting their centers of excellence or cutting their testing team. And as you say, Chris, moving it into their development team, and they're expected to take on more. I mean, what's the right formula here? Is the industry heading in the wrong direction, do you think? Or?
I think a few things. One is we have to realize quality is not optional. We pay for it somehow,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's just inherently baked into what we're delivering. And, you know, one way that teams pay for it, for example, is let's say they don't have good testing practices in place. I've gone into some teams and we measure, you know, what percentage of time are you spending on bugs versus new functionality. I've worked with some teams that are spending 50% of their time on defects. And I've worked with other teams that are spending less than 5% of their time on defects. Both teams same number of people, developers, incredibly talented people, very smart, hardworking, overly busy, struggling to crank out code in between meetings, but doing their best, right? Everything looks identical, except one team is spending half their time on bugs. And you can think of that as being effectively a team that is twice as big, right? If you can have one team that is only working on new functionality, but producing twice the new functionality, that's ultimately what the business cares about. And the thing that gets you there, the lever that you can pull that gets you to spending less than 5% of your time on bugs is focusing on quality. Now, are you going to have more people on your team to write those tests? Probably. Is it going to be 2x? Probably not, right? So somewhere in between there is that sweet spot of now I'm investing in quality so that I can deliver a good result. And oh, by the way, it's not just the 2x people, right? It's if you have a system that's less than 5%, you have happier customers who stick around longer. Mm-hmm. You have a smaller support mm-hmm. team because you don't have to have people doing all these manual workarounds. So the business case for quality has always been there and still is there. It's just we're playing these games of whose budget do we pretend it really comes out right. of? And is it the customer's testing or are we?
Segues nicely into the next question in terms of measuring and how do you measure quality? I guess we've used quality quite a lot here, but it's almost an implied thing that is very intangible. How would an organization, you know, maybe to use your example, right, in terms of the ones that are finding far too many defects, why aren't they achieving the quality and how do they measure that so they can actually do something about it?
Yeah.
Another easy question there for you, Chris.
Yeah. Yeah, so there are a few metrics that I like to track. You know, I've helped teams set up quality dashboards before, and you know, there's the typical metrics of, you know, how many bugs are there? Are they high, medium, or low priority? How long is it taking to fix the bugs? One of my favorites is what I call like your internal defect discovery rate. I don't know if I got that term from somebody else. I might have. But it's how many bugs are you finding internally and fixing before the release versus how many are your customers finding? And on teams that are doing well, you'll see two things happen. One is if you're really doing automated tests, nobody's finding bugs. You're not finding them internally. Your customers aren't finding them either. So both the numerator and the denominator both shrink, right? Yep. And that's really where you want to be. But if people are finding bugs because there aren't tests, you want your team internally to be finding those before they escape to the customer. And so that's a really nice metric to take a look at. What percentage of your tests are automated? How long are they running? Are they flaky or not? But we started this conversation with quality is a lot more than testing, right? So you also need to, I think, look at like what are your customer satisfaction scores? How much time are your support or account management teams spending on issues? And those are important metrics to keep in mind that can give you a more holistic picture of quality.
A lot of these metrics are always kind of on the right-hand side. It's always after we've kind of, it's focusing on the aftermath, I guess, right? Like how many defects escaped from production? How much time have we spent fixing bugs on XYZ, you know, churn, etc. But I wonder if there's kind of other metrics as well, like looking internally at, you know, kind of the almost the separation of knowledge and this concept of having silos of knowledge, which I think you touched on at the beginning, Chris. You know, how well are our teams collaborating together? Maybe there's potentially early warning signs as well, like we have a developer who's worked on a particular function or, you know, unit of code that, you know, they're not familiar with, right? I wonder if there's kind of early warning signs and triggers that you could look at on the team level.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, code coverage, of course. Like, that's a good leading indicator. A team with less than 80% code coverage is far more likely to be a team that has a high defect escape rate. But you know, some of that also depends on like what your approach is. So when we were doing extreme programming, for example, one of the things we tracked was what's our story size. So do we have big stories or do we have small stories? We tracked how often are we pairing and how often are we switching who we're pairing with. When you measure these things, you'll see that there's a correlation between doing the activity and getting the result. And, you know, I'm not here to say like everybody should be doing extreme programming and, you know, if pair programming is going to automatically fix everybody's quality issues and be the right solution for everyone. But the leading indicators from an organization side tend to be things like that. Like, you know, if you have people working as pairs, or let's say you're doing PR reviews, like reviewing pull requests, right? That's something you can measure. You can measure whether or not people are reviewing their pull requests, and you can measure how big those pull requests are. And I guarantee you that a team that has large merges that aren't reviewed is going to be producing a lower quality result than teams that have smaller merges that are regularly reviewed by one or more people, right? That's just a thing that anybody who's been doing this long enough knows, right? But it's a thing we can also measure, and a lot of teams don't measure those types of things.
Do you think there are any enterprise measures? You mentioned kind of large organizations have a lot of complexity, right? And that's been built in over many, many years. I'm going to suggest through either bad architecture or just no architecture, right? It's just evolved into what it's become. And so there are so many problems in almost the here and the now and the accidental issues that we find and the costs that we bear through the change. Do you think there's measures around that? And do you think almost in order for an organization to become more agile, small iterative delivery, they need to untangle that? And without doing that, then they're doomed to just bolting on crap onto the big ball of mud, right?
I'm going to say something possibly controversial.
Please say it.
One of the biggest misnomers about Agile is that a lot of people think Agile means that you don't have a plan, that you're just going in, you know, one sprint at a time with one backlog, grabbing the things that are at the top of the list. But when Agile is done well, it should be done within the context of a good plan and a good vision. And that plan and vision shouldn't just be on the business side. It should also be on the technical architecture side.
Yeah.
And when it comes to quality, I think it's very, very underappreciated how important nailing down a good architecture is in terms of your ability to deliver on a quality result. So, you know, take the web pages of the 90s and early 2000s, when I was out doing this stuff, you know, we had database queries embedded in the same source code as what was generating the server-side HTML that was going to get delivered to the customer. You know, so you change a database query, now you have to go through at the user interface level and fully test everything in order to determine all of the impacts of that one change in a database query. In the modern architecture, you know, now we of course have, you know, your single page apps that talk to an API. The API is the only thing that has access to that table in your entire organization anywhere. So you know with 100% certainty, and you can even enforce this at the architectural layer and at the security layers, you can know with 100% certainty that if I rename that column to something else, the only place that's going to change is in the API. And it's that 100% certainty that's guaranteed to me by the architecture and by the security policies and permission structure that guarantees that I don't need to run all of those other tests that I used to have to run when that database query was embedded in the web pages, right?
Yeah.
So that's an obvious one. But think about that for a second in terms of all the other architectural decisions we make today. Should it be one microservice? Should it be 10 microservices? What should the microservice be responsible for? What's going to depend on that microservice? Who's the team going to be? All of those decisions can influence whether or not we need to run a bunch of end-to-end tests. Absolutely. Or we're comfortable just testing that component in isolation. And so when it comes to that big enterprise, if they don't have that plan and architectural overview of here's how we're going to unwind this behemoth, monolithic pile of junk that we've built over the last 50 years, they're going to miss out real opportunities to say, okay, here's a piece of it that we understand really well, that's not changing from an interface perspective a whole lot, that a team can really understand, really own, and really test well. And then they can do things like contract testing with the other teams to prove that, yes, I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I think that's critical if people want to have high-quality organizations right now.
Cool. And that's almost – that's the blueprint, right, for any organization, I would suggest. Do you see that conversation a lot happening?
I think you don't. And the reason that you don't is because – when we abandoned Waterfall to go to Agile, some of those initial roles that were around of, you know, being the systems analyst, for example, a lot of the architects, you don't have quite as many architects anymore. And those roles, by the way, when poorly executed are, I mean, it's just miserable, right? So no one wants to be in a situation where they can't use the latest library when it's the right library for the job, just because there's like some other person who has a political bent against you using that particular library, right? But when you have like real like CTOs and architects and systems analysts looking at the big picture, you can identify big areas of opportunity for pulling things apart in a way that you know certain components are going to do what they're supposed to do. And I think that's really important for these organizations to figure out.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's funny because as a end user consumer of some software, so if I go into some of my more traditional bank accounts, I guess, I can just tell there is a mainframe sat behind this thing, right? Because I click on buttons to go and view, you know, my balance, whatever, and it takes me ages to get to that point. Whereas I have some other bank accounts who like Monzo, Revolut, and it's just instantaneous, right?
Yeah,
I've had the same experience recently with an airline. I'm not going to name who they are, but I'll log in there. And I would say there's probably about a 30% success rate that it actually ends up getting me to where I want to go and view, you know, my flights that I have booked, etc. The other 70% of the time, it never works. And, you know, you're there at the airline desk, you're looking behind the screen, and you can see that it's still like a emulator terminal that they're connecting into, right? So as an end user, I can tell when there's bad architecture 100%. So I'm almost surprised that a lot of organizations don't take it more seriously, especially now there's such a kind of flattening of the competitive landscape.
And I think, you know, one of the reasons why, and this kind of circles back to this whole conversation, is in order to make big sweeping changes, you have to have a lot of comfort that you fully understand how the system works and that your changes aren't going to break it. And I don't know a way to do that without having good test automation in place. So if you don't have the test automation in place, the first step is putting it in place somewhere, right? There was a really good book by, I believe it's Michael Feathers, that was working effectively with legacy code, that even talks about, you know, don't write the test to test what you're changing, write what I think he called them characterization tests. So this is just a test that you can run that tells you, did the thing change or not, right? And so you can go into a legacy system and you can put in tests that you know with certainty, because you pull them out before you deploy to production, that you're not going to break production by inserting the test. But by having the test there, you now have something you can run to make sure the changes that you are making don't break the system or change its behavior in an unintended way, right? And so for these legacy architectures, you know, it's a big daunting task to take that on, but it's achievable, right? And And so you can go into that system, you can start wrapping it with tests, and you might find out that while you're writing the test, now we've just developed such a big understanding of the problem, we're fully comfortable keeping only the tests and throwing away the system that sits underneath it and replacing it with something better, right? But I don't see how you could be comfortable doing that without having the tests in place first.
I guess last subject is one of James's favorites. So what role do you think AI might play in terms of...
There we go.
Either, I guess in terms of either measuring quality or understanding impact of change, I guess, based on the conversation we've just been having.
Look, I think AI is going to have a huge impact on being able to understand systems and understand change. You know, if you look at even what's out there with ChatGPT at the moment, I can go in there, I can connect it to a bunch of data sources in the back end, I can start asking questions, and I can get back some kind of answer with some kind of reasoning around what I've given it. And it's usually pretty good, right? It's not 100%, it's kind of 80%. And I think that aligns with what we're seeing in a lot of organizations at the moment. They're treating it with kind of this whole co-pilot mantra rather than it being autopilot. I think it's a great accelerator. I think it can help organizations understand and kind of reduce this kind of technical debt they've built up over time if they have some kind of knowledge it can connect to. Do I think we're going to see it in the next year? Probably not. Do I think once we have a lot of these connectors into source code, into different repositories, you know, organizations are training their own LLMs, et cetera, probably I think we'll get there. But it's going to take time, right? Would you trust it ever wholeheartedly by itself? Probably not. And I think you also have to kind of think about this whole, you know, if I'm a human and I'm struggling to do a task and I'm struggling to get all the information together to perform a migration or to reduce technical debt, is a system going to be able to do it for me automatically? Probably not. So I think there's going to be a lot of work to do. I think there's going to be more work in an organization to set up the data sets and to set up the data and to set up the knowledge and probably, you know, the ability of the algorithms, to be honest. Chris, what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I've got so much to say about this topic. you know, one of the things I think about a lot is, you know, anytime there's a big new technology, the people who need to watch out the most are the people where that's the technology they do, right? So when the calculator got replaced by the spreadsheet, if your job was selling calculators or using calculators, you needed to switch to the spreadsheet, just like the spreadsheet folks needed to switch to the database. So when it comes to testing, you know, there are going to be new tasks that we can do with AI. And if we leverage AI, we'll be better and more efficient at doing those tasks. It'll be helping us out. And we're probably in real trouble if we don't switch to those things. But there are also some aspects of AI that are going to make the need for people who really understand how to test systems even greater, right? Mm-hmm. There's this whole idea of generative AI being able to create hallucinations where it just makes up things. There's a certain, you know, non-deterministic nature of it. So you don't always get the same answer whenever you ask the same question. Those types of things make it so much harder to test whether or not a system is working properly. And so will we leverage AI to test systems that are built with AI? You know, I think that's, of course we will. But it's going to be a harder challenge and it's still going to require skilled people who understand how to use the tools and techniques to figure it out. And to me, that's a really interesting time to be in right now.
If you could give one piece of advice to anybody looking to up quality just a notch, what would that piece of advice be?
Probably the best place to go is take a look at the last 10 bugs that were reported by your customers and go out and write a test for them if you don't already have one.
When you said the best place to go, I thought you were going to plug Testry then.
Oh.
What about yourself, James?
Yeah, I don't know. I feel like a lot of what we spoke about in this podcast has just been a lot of inefficiencies, I think, a lot of people spending time doing the wrong thing. To me, it always comes back with starting with, why am I doing this? What is the value I'm trying to get out of it? And hopefully that frees up some time that you can actually go out and invest some time in automation, to Chris's point, invest some more time in creating tests, invest more time in doing more earlier, creating more solid requirements and everything else flowing off of it. So I think for me, you know, organizations, there's a lot of cuts going on, to be frank. Budgets are getting smaller, and any ability to free up more time, become more efficient, that's kind of the gold rush at the moment, right? That's where organizations need to get to. And I think with that, you know, hopefully you can start working more intelligently and there's more time for quality as part of it. That would be my take, I think.
Some great insights, some great conversations, some great views. Look out for the next edition of Why Don't You Test That podcast. But for now, a big thank you to James, my co-host, and to Chris, our star guest for today. Thanks a lot, everybody. Goodbye.
Thank you so much, Chris. Thanks, Rich.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Why Didn't You Test That podcast. To continue the conversation, head over to curiositysoftware.ie. And don't forget to subscribe for more episodes.